McBride v. Grice. Mr. Stegall.
Thank you, Judge Posner. This is a Section 1983 false arrest claim. My client is a small clothing store who operates. He had a disturbance with his employee and friend who wanted to leave. He told her she left, did not come back. A disagreement occurred. It escalated. He told her if she didn't calm down, he would push his wireless to call the police. He called the police. 20 to 30 minutes later, the defendant officer came to the premises. In the meantime, after she'd refused to leave, my client evicted her, put a bear hug on her from behind, and walked her out, a mild means of evicting someone unruly from your premises.
Well, that's not what she told the officer, of course.
Well, that's not what the officer said she told her. Her testimony was that it was a tussle. So, again,
at the scene, she told the officer that he slugged her, right?
Well, the officer says that, yes. But she says that it was a tussle. So that's a question of who we believe. Between what she said in her deposition.
She recanted what she told the officer, or?
Well, I asked her the question of what happened, and she described it as a tussle. And then there were a number of questions as from the officer's counsel about what happened. And so we have one of those credibility situations.
So she denied in her deposition telling the officer that your client hit her?
I know of no evidence to that, Your Honor.
Okay.
I will look at the record that she said in the deposition, confirmed she told the officer that he slugged her. I know of no evidence to that. It's a good point you raise. Again, we're talking later, but she's describing what happened, and those are the credibility situations we get into.
We have to evaluate the probable cause from the standpoint of the officer at the scene.
Yes, based on the testimony of what happened from everybody involved. The problem I have with the scenario you're putting is that we accept what he says when there's conflicting evidence of someone else. And that's the problem with the scenario you're putting to me.
Well, what's undisputed? They got into an argument.
Right.
And it escalated into a physical altercation of some sort, whether he hit her or it was just some undifferentiated tussle.
Right.
And he hauled her out of the store.
Right. And he was arrested for battery, which actually an element of the offense is lack of justification, as well as a defense to it. You can use self-defense to evict someone.
Well, that's an affirmative defense, though. That doesn't negate probable cause.
Well, it's an interesting question in battery because it's an element of the offense that you do it without justification. So it's an interesting question that we can debate how many angels on the head of the pin, which way that goes. But the statute, the elements are without justification. And certainly my position, and I think the evidence is clear, that the way the officer reacted here, he came. He says on appeal, they say, well, the officer didn't know there was a disturbance. Well, the store owner had called him. There was a rack of clothes down. There were two customers in there. He never interviewed the customers. He told him right away, to get somebody to come in, I'm going to arrest you for battery on your girlfriend, after hearing the girlfriend's story, who, knowing of the call to the police, had certainly had an incentive to call on her own and say that she was battered. My client prevailed upon him after the officer dismissed the two witnesses who actually saw what happened. My client prevailed on him to go look at the tapes. Well, there's two views. He looks at only one. He says, well, wait a minute, here it is. Nope, don't want to see it. It's not clear. Well, I submit to you the officer's testimony itself. Well, it's not clear. He never considered justification. And that was one of the errors of law that I find below, is that the Judge Gorman, who's very able, I've consented to him and will many times, and an experienced judge, said that, well, you don't have to look into defense. Well, you do when it's staring you right in the eye. And you just look, call. Shop owner calls about a disturbance. Someone is outside, admittedly evicted from the premises, and you don't look into whether the justification is there. And I have the Illinois cases on that. We come into a classic question of fact, certainly based on the fact he was called.
His removing her physically was a dumb move.
Well, I don't know when she starts knocking.
I mean, call the police. The police can come and remove a person. You don't start pushing people out of a store. That doesn't make any sense.
Well, it may be a dumb move. Certainly in retrospect, Your Honor, I would agree. It was a dumb move. That's why we're here. But he has a right when she knocks over a clothing rack and one of the customers leave and the police aren't coming. There was a 20 to 30 minute delay. How long does he let it go? There are parts on the tape to show that she keeps coming back at him. And again, I come back to, shop owner has a right to evict a trespasser. And once you tell somebody to leave, they don't calm down, you have a legal right to. The judge never considered that on summary judgment and said the officer didn't have to. Well, he does have to. And then there's the other problem with the burden of proof in this. When you look at what happened is whose versions, and what happens is qualified immunity wasn't asserted as a defense. So,
well, a police officer isn't going to adjudicate whether he used reasonable force to remove someone.
Well, he's going to ask. I mean, he's got to ask when you go to the premises.
She wasn't breaking things when he picked her up and dragged her out.
There was a rack that was turned over.
That was in the process of his taking her out. She didn't knock a rack over and then he takes her out. She's struggling while he's pushing her out.
And also creating a disturbance that won't leave, telling customers to leave, swearing.
Well, that's different. Of course she's behaving improperly, and he's entitled to call the police. But as I say, if you start dragging people out of your store and the police arrive, yeah, they're going to assume there's, you know, battery going on here. It's very unusual for someone physically to eject his employee in this fashion.
I beg to differ with you. The bar room cases happen all the time in small stores. Well, it does. And the reason you don't see it, Your Honor.
Central District of Illinois.
Well, it happens in this city, I would submit to Your Honor. You may not believe it because you don't see a case because the veteran officer goes out there and says, whoa, store owner gets employee out of control. We got employee out. No harm, no foul. We go home.
That's a matter of officer discretion, though. That's not an argument against the existence of probable cause, and that's what this case turns on.
Well, again, does it turn as a matter of law, or do we determine the facts as to what the officer's intent was, or do we accept his version after the event? And that's what I submit to you the case is. Summary judgment is not a place for that. It's becoming a norm, but that's certainly not the way it's set up, is that the police officer says, this is what I did. There are circumstances beginning the reason for the call. He never makes inquiry. Never talks to the customers. One of them had left before because of the disturbance. And if you take the position we're heading here is, well, the officer says that it's so. And I submit to you that that's not what the burden is, nor what it should be. Because the officer's encounters with police do have the burden of justifying what they do based on everything. And to look at all the circumstances. And he made the call. Police were late. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Stiegel. Mr. Madison?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Garth Madison. I'm arguing on behalf of the defendant appellees, the City of Peoria, and Officer Brian Grice. Plaintiff's basic argument here is that he can somehow negate probable cause by this supposed evidence that exists that Officer Grice should have investigated to find out, to establish his affirmative defense of evicting a trespasser. And I find it interesting that plaintiff's counsel let off with this calm, reasoned description of this eviction, as if he was just simply escorting her out of the store, especially when he relies so heavily on the videotape, which doesn't show that calm, reasoned approach by a shopkeep at all. This is not a rational shopkeep who's calmly explaining to the officer arriving on the scene how he evicted a trespasser. This is Mr. McBride, and actually in Officer Grice's description, Mr. McBride was uncooperative. He had a number of people lingering about the store that he was talking to. He was at times angry. And Mr. McBride admitted that he had this female employee who was terminated. She comes back looking for a final paycheck, and there's some verbal argument that arises out of that. Both parties admitted that, and both parties admit that verbal argument escalated into a physical altercation. And we're looking at probable cause from the information that the officer had at the time of the arrest. And he's got that admission by both parties. He's got the victim's statement, as was pointed out, that McBride struck her with his closed fist.
Did she back away from that in her deposition?
She did not, Your Honor. She specifically, when asked about that, I don't have the record site, but her deposition, page 40, she specifically is asked, did you tell the officer that Mr. McBride struck you in the face with a closed fist? Answer, yes. Okay, do you know what hand he struck you with? Right. Meaning right hand. So, we have that, and more than that, we have Officer Grice's own observations of the parties involved. He's got scratches on the parties. He's got a black eye on the victim, this female, this woman. And
he arrested them both, didn't he?
He arrested them both. He's got essentially what's a domestic dispute here, between Mr. McBride and his girlfriend / employee, and he arrests them both. He's got clear information that battery occurred. He's got probable cause. I think that's pretty clear, as the district court recognized. And Mr. McBride's protestations of innocence were contradicted by all of the other information, including Mr. McBride's own admission that Officer Grice had at the time. And he's saying, well, the officer ignored that. Ignored this potential defense. Well, what Mr. McBride said to the officer at the time was, well, I've got this videotape that shows that, I'm innocent, that I didn't do anything to her. He's going on about this videotape. Did Officer Grice ignore that? No. He went with Mr. McBride to view the video, the supposed video evidence. Mr. McBride, he watched Mr. McBride for several minutes by his testimony, at least 2 minutes by Mr. McBride's own testimony. He watches while Mr. McBride tries to cue this video up. Officer Grice says that Mr. McBride did not seem very facile with the equipment, but he did watch, and he did get at least one of the two camera angles, and it did not support what Mr. McBride was saying about his innocence. If anything, it corroborated that there was physical contact between the two. Plaintiff here is talking about this. He cites the cases in his brief. He's trying to establish some absolute duty to investigate that simply does not exist under the law. The cases that he cites are either where probable cause initially exists, seems to be established, but there's subsequent evidence that comes to the officer's mind, knowledge, that dissipates probable cause. The officer's conduct from that point on, either arrest or maintaining custody, can be violative of Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable seizure. But again, the key is the knowledge, the information at the time of the conduct. And the other cases that show, that try to state some affirmative duty to investigate, are when the officer lacks information regarding an element of the offense, which did not exist here. The 1986 Seventh Circuit case, Bevier v. Huchal, that the plaintiff cites, for instance, that there was no evidence of the intent element of child abuse, and in fact there was contrary evidence that the plaintiff parents had attempted to remedy the situation. And the Seventh Circuit, this court in that case said, an officer who has established cause on every element of the crime need not continue investigating to check out leads or test the suspect's claim of innocence. That's the case the plaintiff himself is citing to this court. It's not the case here where, Officer Grice had information establishing all the elements of battery, and he acted on that. I think it's key too. You've got again plaintiff's argument about burden. He claims that the burden is on the defendant. Again, we deal with that in our briefs, but the Reynolds case, the 2007 decision by this court. Again, the burden is on the plaintiff to, in order to survive a motion for summary judgment, has to show sufficient evidence that would allow a jury to conclude that the officer unreasonably believed that the plaintiff had committed the offense. That's just not the case here. The plaintiff has completely failed to show unreasonableness. Again, the two big pieces of evidence that plaintiff is relying on here, the video, that's not the smoking gun that plaintiff suggests it is. He mischaracterizes how Officer Grice approached the video. Officer Grice did actually take time to investigate this supposed exculpatory evidence. It doesn't help plaintiff. He also has this argument about it being our job to attach it to the summary judgment motion. That's not the defendant's job. That's the plaintiff's job. And in fact, the plaintiff did put that video evidence in its entirety before the district judge. The district judge looks at it and says, "No, this doesn't create a genuine issue." And I think the district judge was very correct when he dropped a footnote in his opinion, saying both parties rely on the videotape too much. It just doesn't show all of the action. It doesn't show all of the body parts of the people over this time period where they're arguing and going back and forth and attacking each other, engaging in physical contact. I think the district judge's summary judgment opinion was very clearly and very thoroughly set out to plaintiff and his attorney what the law in this circuit is and what the application of the summary judgment standard to the facts of this case are.
Thank you, Mr. Madison.
Thank you.
And we thank Mr. Stiegel also. Your time had expired, had it not? Do you have a minute? Okay. You want a minute?
I have to say, with dismissive, at some point in time, we have to follow burdens. The burden of proof's on the defendant. If you don't have qualified.
No, that's wrong, counsel. You've got the burden of proof.
Well, okay. I did cite the case, and if I'm wrong, then you rule that. But also on the summary judgment, there wasn't any plaintiff can't prove this. You have to bring forward all the evidence because it's there. You can't just say, well, he ignored this. And the point is there's two witnesses there. The evidence construed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff is that the guy made up his mind and refused to look at everything. What's an extra minute or two to look at the tape and to talk to the customers? He spent a lot of time with the person who accused, and we come back to the basic fact, which I may be in a different forum, but if considering the credibility is, shop owner calls, yet he never talks to the shop owner about it. He's already made his decision to arrest before he even talks to him. Thank you.
Okay, thank you to both counsel. Last case for